Hello, friends, and welcome. I'm your co-host, Andrew Lazaga, here with Dubside.
And you're listening to The Dubcast with Dubside.
Dubside has just returned from attending the Minnesota Traditional Paddlers Gathering, which was held over 4 days, from September 8th to the 11th. So, how was it?
Oh, it was very good. We had pretty good weather. A little rain came through at one point, but it was a little smaller crowd than some years. But that's the one that there's an actual castle on this Boy Scout camp. It's a castle made out of cinder blocks. And we had some Boy Scouts there that came on Saturday, and we did a ropes demonstration. I told them about the Dubcast with Dubside. Sent them all home with guitar picks.
Awesome.
So maybe they'll be listening. They do a kayaking merit badge. So we give them a special side of kayaking they wouldn't get anywhere else, talking about all the traditional stuff. Had them throwing harpoons on land and some kayaks in the water and did rope stuff. So they had a good time.
So did you get to stay in the castle?
Oh, yes, I did. They'd have all these different rooms as well as like the barracks kind of thing. So I stayed in there. Very comfortable surroundings there. And so on the Friday evening program, the organizer, Peter Strand is his name, had asked me to do something. So I suggested I do it, record a live episode of the Dubcast. And so he let me do that. Hmm. So I brought this, my audio equipment, had the microphones on the tables, a couple of people mic'd up with lavaliers and a microphone for me. And we did that. And that will be episode 38, which it'll be a while before that one gets heard, because I got a bunch more in the can, so to speak. But it's coming.
Awesome. Looking forward to hearing it. Did you get many comments about the Dubcast?
Yeah, there were some people said they'd been listening to it and they enjoyed it. So, yeah.
By the way, I really enjoyed your medley of Greenlandic songs.
Well, thank you.
And people have been commenting that they'd like to see an album of all your recordings.
Oh, well, the idea is to get people to buy the Greenlandic music. But I suppose, I've got that wasn't even all of them. We're up to 30 episodes, and some of those with kayak songs double the two, but I've got at least like a 25 or so recordings. And then the ones that are coming up yet, I still have more coming. So I suppose I do have a good collection of songs. I listen back to them, and some of them I'm thinking, maybe I should. We should fix that a little bit. And other ones that sound not too bad.
Okay, well, I want to thank our listeners for tuning in, and a warm welcome to those who are new to the Dubcast. And for those of you who are longtime listeners, thanks for sticking with us. We have a lot more planned for the future.
Yes, indeed.
So let's proceed to Dubcast 31.
Yep, here it is.
Welcome to the Dubcast with Dubside. This is Dubcast number 31. The subject is navigation and the use of a compass. Although we're not going to get into the complexities of it, just some basic stuff. Tell you about a guy who was one of my first kayak instructors, who was very present back in the day, but hasn't been seen in many years. His name is Ray Killen. Music this week from a group called Tushlait. It's even a challenge to say the names of these groups sometimes. Tushlait. T-U-L-L-E-R-I-I-T. Tushlait. Well, if you go into the annals of sports history and look up the world records for pole vaulting, and you will find that in the late 1950s, there was a guy named Don Bragg. And at this time period, they were using steel or aluminum poles. And he was said to be the last of the great metal pole vaulters. And he held the world record for a time of 15 feet, 8 3/4 inches, clearing that with a pole. And sometime after that, the fiberglass poles came in, and then the record nowadays, I think they're up there, they can get to higher than 20 feet. But back then, he was the man, and he won the Olympic gold medal in pole vaulting in 1960. And Don Bragg was a big, big guy, physically large for a pole vaulter. It sounds like he had a large personality to match. He was known to be quite enamored of the character Tarzan, to the point where he would break into a Tarzan yell, even when standing on the platform at competitions after getting a medal. Now, what could Don Bragg possibly have to do with kayaking? Well, keep listening. When you get in a kayak and travel some distance from shore, at some point it becomes necessary to know exactly where you are. And like any ship on the sea, a basic tool for that is a compass. And this distinguishes sea kayaking from whitewater kayaking. In whitewater kayaking, you just follow the course of the river. But in sea kayaking, you need to know where you are, and a compass helps you do that. Some of the higher-end fiberglass kayaks have a compass. They come with a compass installed on the deck. But otherwise, you can buy a separate compass and add it on. And early on in my kayaking with my folding kayak, I couldn't get the kind that where you just screw it onto the deck and mount it there, because it's a folding kayak. So I had, there are ones that are use some bungee elastics and hooks and fasten onto the deck lines on the side. And I got the one made by Suunto, S-U-U-N-T-O. Cost me about $40. So you put it on the deck, and then you have it set up so that wherever you point the kayak, the compass tells you which way you're pointed. Now, the kind of compass you use on land, you hold in your hands and you look at your map with. But when you're kayaking, your hands are busy with the paddle. So you just want to have it on the deck, and you can see where you're going just by looking at it. It's got to be large enough for you to read from a few feet away. If you're interested in Greenland kayaking, well, the Greenlanders didn't use compasses, but we do these days. Here's something to avoid. First time I went to Greenland, and the months before that, I was practicing for all the events, which included the harpoon throwing. And we used the Norsok, the throwing stick, which you attach to the harpoon and use that as an extension of your arm. And so in getting a feel for how this works, it took some time to work out the details. And initially, it's rather a clumsy situation with this paddle in one hand, a harpoon, and a throwing stick. And so I tried to throw the harpoon and neglected to hold on to the throwing stick. I let go of the throwing stick, and it flew forward with the harpoon and came down on my deck right where the compass was, and smashed out a $40 compass. So if you're going to practice the harpoon for the first time, take the compass off of your kayak, or otherwise protect it somehow. So when you first go kayaking, you generally know where you are by just looking at the land. And you can see, you know, that spot there is where I put in at. I'm going to paddle down here along the shoreline here, and there's trees and buildings and whatever kind of landmarks you can come up with. And you can turn around and go back, and you can see where you are, and that's how you go. But if you get into much longer distances, you can be where all you around you is water, and there are no landmarks, and you have to be able to figure out which direction to go, and that's where the compass comes in handy. So here's probably the most basic use of a compass that might come in handy sometimes. Suppose you're out on some large lake, and you're a couple hundred feet from the shore, and you know where you are. You can see things around you. And if you've come to enjoy paddling in all types of weather, you may be in a situation where a rainstorm comes up rather quickly, and you see a front of rain coming towards you, thick, heavy rain, and you're ready to get wet because you're in a kayak and you got your spray skirt, maybe a paddling jacket on, you're ready for the rain. But when the rain hits you, the visibility is going to be severely restricted, and you probably won't even be able to see the land. With heavy rain in the area, you've got maybe 50, 100 feet, and you can't see past that. So what you need to do is, when you see that rain coming, immediately look at your compass and see what course you are paddling on. And then if you keep on that course, you will go where you intended to go. Because when the rain comes in, you lose your direction. If you get spun around, you'll have no idea what you're paddling towards. But keeping your eye on the compass, you can keep going right in that same direction no matter what the visibility is. And that's the very simple version of function of a compass. Now, even when you can see the land, a compass is a useful thing to have to see how well you can paddle in a straight line. Like, you look exactly where your compass is going, maybe it's 130 degrees, and then you don't look at the compass and keep paddling, or even close your eyes for maybe 10 strokes and then look down at the compass. And if you're at 140 degrees, then you're stronger on one side than the other side. So you want an even stroke on both sides, so you're generally going in a straight line, and a compass helps you do that. Now, I was once paddling up in the Adirondacks with my friend Chris Rabb, beautiful area of upstate New York. And we were out for a weekend, extended weekend maybe. So the last day we were paddling back, all packed up the campsite. We're headed back, and it's early morning, and a fog drifts in, or morning fog, and visibility goes down. We couldn't see the shoreline anymore. Total fog, heavy, thick fog. Well, I've got my compass, so I'm looking down. Okay, paddling, let's just say it was 270 degrees heading due west. And so I keep on paddling, and Chris, I can almost make him out. He's, close but not too close, and the fog is very thick. So I'm paddling, and I'm realizing, I'm going in a nice straight line. I've got this worked out pretty well here. And I paddle a little hard on one side just to test, but I'm still going to 270 degrees. Then I paddled, continuous strokes on that side. I'm still going 270 degrees. And I'm looking, something is wrong with this compass. Well, that compass, the air temperature was not below freezing, but somehow the compass froze. It got stuck on 270. Of all the times for the compass to get stuck, when it was heavy fog, when I really needed the compass. Well, it was just a morning fog that burned off pretty quickly, and I was sort of able to follow Chris, and we got to where we were going. But I had to view that compass with a little more suspicion after that. That thing could fail on me at some point. Later it thawed out, or it started to work again, but I always was wondering if it would, just always worried about trusting it completely. So beyond just seeing what direction you're going, compass comes in handy when, say, you're crossing a large passage. It could be a shipping channel or just a big, crossing a river. The river's maybe a mile or more than that wide, river or bay. And it's useful to know when you are at the midpoint. And you can look forward or backward at both sides of the land and maybe try to guess, but that's not a precise method of doing it. But if you can see something on the horizon, sort of to your right or left, say it's a water tower or a mountain range or something, and you can see the angle pointing at that your compass makes. Now, if you look at a map, or just to use proper terminology, as soon as you take a map onto a vessel on the sea, it is called a chart. It's proper terminology. So on a chart, you could calculate ahead of time, looking at the chart, when I'm looking to my left and see that, and then maybe when that water tower is at 190 on a compass, then I'm halfway across. Because as I'm coming up to it, you know, it's maybe 170, 180, and then when it's finally 190, then I'm in the middle of the river. And that's how one way to use the compass there for navigation. Now, if you waited till you were out on the water paddling to figure out these angles and look at your chart and say, okay, where is that going to be, that water tower going to be, at what angle when I'm halfway across? You'd have to stop and take it out and try not to lose it over the side of the deck. And it's rather precarious perched on your spray skirt there. So on a ship or a large boat, you know, they have a table up in the bridge and they put the charts on the table and they have these tools, parallel rulers and things where they can calculate these angles. But for navigating in a kayak, you kind of have to do it ahead of time, do your homework in advance, and then you've got all these angles worked out when you're paddling and when your hands are busy. So the details of this I'm not going to get into, but there's a book that I purchased way back when. It was referred to me. It's called Fundamentals of Kayak Navigation by David Birch. But I'll give you my evaluation of that book. That book is mistitled. It's not the fundamentals. It's everything you'd ever want to know and more than you would want to know about kayak navigation. That it's like an encyclopedia. There's way too many details. It's intimidating to read all this stuff. You're like, what is going on here? It's rather confusing sometimes. So a number of people over the years, and that Birch's book has gone through three or four reprintings, new editions of. It is quite the authoritative work. But there are people who have looked at that and tried to make their own version of a much more simplified way to get a handle on kayak navigation. And one of them was written in 2006 by my original kayak instructor coach, Ray Killen, who lived in New Jersey at the time. And his book is still available. It is called Simple Kayak Navigation by Ray Killen. And he covers further details like magnetic north versus true north and bearing versus heading, and ferry angles and other such concepts. And it's quite possible to enjoy kayaking without getting into navigation if you just stay on basic lakes and small rivers. But if you want to venture out into anything bigger, it becomes necessary to familiarize yourself with the art of navigation. And even just some of the basic ideas come in handy. You don't have to get into all the details in the Birch book. Well, the first year I went to the Delmarva Paddlers Retreat in the first weekend in October. That was 2001, and Ray Killen was there. He was a big presence there. And he was also at the pool sessions where I first learned to roll. And I took the American Canoe Association instructor training from Ray. He was a certified instructor trainer offering the classes. And Chris Rabb, my friend who makes paddles, also took the certification there at the same time. And so to do that, it was 4 days of instruction and then later 3 days of evaluation. We were staying at Ray's residence in southern New Jersey. And he had a very impressive house in the Pine Barrens. You drive down the sandy road, white sand road, and back in among the pine trees. And there's this imposing structure there. It's on a it looked like it was on a lake. It was actually a cranberry bog, which was only a couple inches deep, but a very nice setting. And we decided that this is, if you were going to do a James Bond movie, this would be the set for the movie. And Ray told us that the house was originally built by a guy who had been a champion Olympic pole vaulter, who had set records back when they were using metal poles before the fiberglass poles came in. Does that sound familiar? That is Don Bragg, who I described at the beginning of this dubcast. Having won a gold medal in 1960, and then this being 2001 or 2 or 3, obviously Don Bragg had gotten on in years and I guess decided to relocate somewhere else. But this house had quite a fascinating history. It had these huge picture windows that looked out over the lake. It was a giant-sized living room and a dining room just as large, and had a downstairs part. I think Ray was using it as a workshop to build kayaks. Had this corridor of bedrooms. The master bedroom had this giant bathroom with a jacuzzi, big, huge tub in it. There was quite the impressive place. And so Ray was showing us the house, and there was in the downstairs there were these columns as part of the house that were, it was a tree actually, from like a trunk of a tree. And Ray said that Don had apparently, you know, got this wood from locally and carried it, I guess, over his shoulders. You know, he was Tarzan, right? You know, where the house was being built to put this in place. And I guess, you know, if you're a top Olympic level athlete from back then in the 60s, you know your fellow athletes, professional athletes at the top of their game. And I suppose Don had some friends in that category. And so Ray said that the old timers in the neighborhood would tell you stories about they would be driving, you know, home on the streets in the Pine Barrens, on the roads. And you just look there on the side of the road there, and there would be jogging as training would be Muhammad Ali, who was one of Don Bragg's friends who would come over to the house, I guess, you know, work out while he was visiting there. So I suppose, you know, in this very house that we were hanging out at, you know, Muhammad Ali had stood there and looked out the window and eaten in the kitchen, etc. Very, very colorful history. And as I recall, Ray told me that, you know, it was quite an expensive house for him to buy. But he had the opinion that, you know, if the mortgage gets overbearing and you can't handle it, then you just sell the house. And then even for that time you were there, you lived in a nice house. You know, no, nothing ventured, nothing gained. And so after a couple of years, Ray, he moved to Arkansas somewhere, him and his wife, Margaret. And they sold the house. So I would imagine that house is still there in the Pine Barrens. I don't even recall the address, but I'm pretty sure it's still there somewhere. And I understand that one of Don Bragg's ambitions was to play the role of Tarzan in a Tarzan movie. And he made some attempts to get that worked out, but it never quite came off. And I believe he passed away 2019, not that long ago. Getting back to navigation. I realize that nowadays there's GPS, and you can just push some buttons there without understanding anything and get an idea where you are. But of course, if that fails, there's the old fallback, the stuff that works, that it's a good idea to be familiar with. And for ships and things, there is celestial navigation, looking at the stars, and this is not generally done in a kayak, because you can't hold a sextant in your hand and measure angles to stars while you try to control the kayak with a paddle. So that's generally left to just the ships. But it's interesting to note that the Aleuts, in that long chain of islands that divides the Bering Sea from the Pacific Ocean, they didn't make use of a compass, but they had other ways of orienting themselves. And I think up in that area, the interaction of those two seas between along that island chain is such that the swells, the waves, always go in the same direction. So you can always orient yourself according to your angle with the waves. It's kind of like if you're, say, in the middle of a forest, a dense forest, you can be lost. But if you're in the middle of a dense cornfield, you can always look at the rows of corn and get an idea of which way you're headed. Well, same idea with waves always in the same direction. And there are Polynesian cultures which navigated great distances by boat. And they did use some celestial orientation. A lot of that art has been lost, but there have been attempts to keep it from being lost completely by those who have gone to talk to the elders to learn how it worked. And being very resourceful, you know, on the sea, you can look at things, you know, like, say, birds flying a certain direction, there's smells or temperatures, everything you can pick up and to give clues as to where you are. I knew a guy one time had a captain's license, and he told me he was hired to take a yacht from, I think it was maybe somewhere in the Bahamas, to perhaps New York City. So they're on the high seas, and the owner of the yacht is aboard, and suddenly the compass just dies. It malfunctions. It, like me up in the Adirondacks, except he's out in the Atlantic Ocean. And so the yacht owner is figuring, that's it. We have to, you know, mayday call. We're stuck here. But the guy that I knew, he said, oh well, let's take a look around. And he says, well, you see what up in the sky there? There's planes. I see every so often a plane is going overhead. And let's just take a look closer at that. Well, these planes are probably lining up on a flight path to go to, maybe it could be, you know, Miami Airport or somewhere along the east coast of the U.S. So let's just follow these planes for long enough, and we'll probably hit the coast. And that's what they did. The way I see it, the more backup plans you have, the safer you are. Okay, musically, got a group out of Greenland, three brothers with the last name Zeeb, and there's a fourth band member, and they call themselves Tulleriit, Tulleriit. Now, that word Tushlia, that's the word that I use if in competition if you want to skip a move. Tushlia means just the next one. So, you know, they're calling out the difficult roles, and you can't do the straitjacket role. You just say Tushlia, Tushlia, and go to the next one. So Tushleit could mean, I don't know, the next ones or the succession or something like that. And this CD has the words in Greenlandic, but there's no English translations. So there's a song called Kalalepalak. And I don't know exactly what they're talking about, but I can guess this is something of a lament. Chorus says something like, oh, it's blindness. We don't sing that way anymore. We don't dress up anymore. Perhaps it's referring to old traditions that are being lost, but I'm not really sure. I think I can safely say that this is somewhat of a sad song.
Nam litanna sakina tut kingona karangaso Jack maishli tegle pogut suner na kasimanit sutu Janna mango sionisami kalipase suisu sabi Tapi susek Tapi susek Winagi matasa Atisagi matasa Atakina zua Tapi susek Masa maku aragasu besosu asu abisu it Kasa sumi ngoi wasu asu magalu anangoteke Tama mami wagushu ta kingone kapugut namine Kala le pala Kala le pala Kala le pala
The original version of that song appears on the Songs of Greenland compilation CD, which I recommend because it also contains many of the other artists I've done, including Susat, Tuparnak, Nanuk, Kishima, Nina, Rikka. So you can't go wrong buying that. But the original album that appeared on was Tushlevit's first CD, which is entitled Ituinerat and available on greenlandmusic.gl. Now, as I said, this one has all the lyrics in Greenlandic, no lyrics in English, and at least they've made them legible. Some of the CDs I have, they've used very funny type fonts, and they'll print the lyrics over top of a picture in the background with the colors clashing. And so it's very difficult to read. You know, you get out a magnifying glass, and even to see what the letters are, it's a different language, and then the letters are hard to read. Yeah, maybe they should print these a little more legibly. Ah! Did you hear that? What happened there? I said they should print these a little more legibly. There is that word should. There is that word should. And that means I need to stop and ask myself three questions. Am I an expert in music promotion or CDs liner notes? I do not have a PhD in that field, so I have to answer no to that question. Have I considered what the CDs are like in Greenland, historically, culturally, and geographically? Not really. So no to that question. And has anyone asked for my opinion on how these CDs should look? No. So I guess I need to shut up and listen. Well, episode 32, I'm going to revisit that cultural differences navigation theme and the toolkit. And we'll look at some more examples of those situations. That's all coming up in Dubcast 31 Tushlia. That'll be Dubcast 31, the next one, which is Dubcast 32.